Sharna Goldsecker is a co-author of Generation Impact, a book that looks at Generation X and millennial philanthropists. She took part in a forum last week as part of the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations 2018 conference and sat down to talk with us.
The next generation, Gen X and millennials, stand to be the most significant generation of donors ever. We are amid the largest wealth transfer in history, $43 trillion, revised up to $59 trillion with inflation recently, is going to be transferred to the next generation within the next 50 years. $59 trillion, significant impact they stand to have on our climate, on our culture, our economy, our education system, and it behooves all of us to understand who they are and how they approach giving. So most of us, when we think about the field of philanthropy, probably picture the old stalwarts like Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Julius Rosenwald, right, who were the icons of the Gilded Age of philanthropy. And now what I think you're referring to is we've been calling the Golden Age of philanthropy. So in addition to those who are inheriting philanthropic wealth, there's also a new gold rush happening in Silicon Valley and on Wall Street and other places. And so we are seeing young entrepreneurs from companies such as name brand companies in Silicon Valley who are setting up private foundations. What's interesting, though, is we found they're really focusing on making an impact. And so sometimes that means they're also setting up C4s and PACs to make an impact on national policy by contributing to advocacy, or even setting up LLCs, for-profit organizations, so they have the flexibility to invest in social businesses that are going to make an impact on the society, using all the tools in the toolbox to affect change because change is needed.
So I imagine then you think that's a good thing.
Well, I think there are a lot of entrenched problems we have in society, and we need all of the best minds and all the resources we can muster to, whether it's solve poverty or the climate crisis or improve our public education school system. So, yes, I think typically donors waited till the sunset of their lives to retire into philanthropic leisure. And now we have younger generations saying, I'm not waiting. The needs are great. I have some resources, maybe not as much as my elders do, but I'm getting there. And I want to make a difference now.
So if you're on the agency side looking for someone to donate, what should you be mining? I mean, what's the mindset of the younger generation?
So I think they want to make an impact. The more we can think about young donors as people, as humans, as individuals who have values and interests of their own, rather than someone to sell to or pitch to or transact to, right? Not to think about them as an ATM. A lot of young people say, well, nonprofit professionals, fundraisers come to us. They look like they have dollar signs in their eyes because they see us as a new source of funding for the organization, and rightly so. But on the other side, I'm just me trying to figure out how to align my values with the issues that I care about. And so trying to build a relationship first, I think, is the best place to start. And starting with values and understanding how, by giving to your organization, you might give them a way to express their values. Next-gen donors are trying to be as strategic as possible. They don't want to, as one said to me, spread thin like peanut butter across a lot of issues, a lot of organizations. They have values that they align with their interests. They pick a few organizations. And the bonus of that is they go all in. They don't just want to write a check. They want to give of their time, their talent, and their ties, as well as their treasure, when they find things that they care about and they feel like will make a meaningful difference in society.
Right. So how can you be impactful?
Exactly. And I think the more we can be courageous enough to be transparent about what our organization is successful at doing and maybe where some of our challenges are, the next gen feel like, I want to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly. So roll up your sleeves. I'm willing to roll up mine. Let's become partners in this endeavor. Nonprofits don't always feel like they can be that authentic, to use your word, with the next gen they can.
So whether it's a Bill and Melinda Gates or a Pierre Omidyar, I guess they basically look to see, okay, what's important? Where's the need? Where can we make a difference?
So I will say that my research, which culminated in the book Generation Impact, How Next Gen Donors Are Revolutionizing Giving, looked at 20 and 30 something. So even the next generation younger than Bill and Melinda Gates, for example, was who we studied. We did a national survey, myself and my colleague Michael Moody. We did in-depth interviews to really understand who Gen X and millennials are as they come into the world of giving. And certainly people like the Gateses are our mentors, role models for a lot of them, because they're willing to have bold vision, they're willing to address what the issues are, to take risks, to learn from the nonprofits in the field what they feel like the needs are, do research when necessary, be as strategic as possible to make a difference. Whether it was people who have earned wealth or who have inherited wealth, we heard everyone say, you know, I came from somewhere. I stand on the shoulders of people who have sacrificed to give me the opportunities I had in life. And so I want to build on that legacy. I want to make my parents proud and honor what they started, whether they were wealthy or not wealthy. They helped me get to where I am. But I also want to take that to the next level. I want to make my own difference in the world, too. And so I encourage people who are just starting out. I appreciate you saying you don't have to be Bill and Melinda Gates to start out, right? You can start small, to think about where they come from, what's the legacy they're honoring, and also who are they? What do they value? What's the impact they want to have on important issues of the day?
Right, and if there's just some basic needs, whether it's shelter, water.
And interestingly, the next generation seems to care about or prioritize similar issues than previous generations. Education, basic needs, as you've mentioned. Maybe climate change is rising to the top with next gen, even more than with previous generations. The thing that's different is how they are approaching their giving. Not so much as what they're funding, those issues are similar, but how they're approaching their giving is what's strikingly different from previous generations.
So what else are you seeing?
Well, a lot of people said, we think the previous generations are funding out of a sense of duty or obligation, or sometimes their friends ask them to give to an organization, and it's maybe quid pro quo. They're prioritizing impact. One young donor said to us, he's in San Francisco, he said, you can't keep doing the same things and expecting different results. We have severe challenges with poverty in Bay Area. How can we do something different to really move the needle?
Are you seeing more with, let's say, homelessness? Because that's a big issue back there in the Bay Area.
Yeah, the Tipping Point Foundation, for example, run by Daniel Laurie. So in our book, we interviewed 75 people, a baker's dozen, 13 of them agreed to not be anonymous. Daniel Laurie is one of them. He founded the Tipping Point Foundation, has had a huge success in prioritizing 44 nonprofits to really focus on, give them operating support, collect data about where they're making an impact, doubling down with some of them on R&D grants. He said, if the corporate world can invest in innovation, we should too, to be able to move the needle and major issues like poverty and housing, et cetera.
And what about green causes? Because we're seeing so much happen with climate change, with these crazy storms and, you know, just things that were out of the ordinary before now becoming very ordinary. And it's like, yikes.
Yeah, I think about Justin Rockefeller, another person that we interviewed for the book. He serves on the board of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund along with his sister, Valerie. And they and the investment committee made a decision to actually divest from fossil fuels, the very industry in which, as you know, the Rockefeller family earned their wealth. But if they were going to fund issues of climate change through their grant making, they didn't want to be investing in fossil fuels on the asset side. So in 2014, made a decision to divest from those kinds of companies in order to improve the impact they could have on the climate. I think there's lots of excitement about the next generation, but I also found lots of earnestness and humility from the next gen, who said, we don't have all the answers. We actually would like to work in a multi-generational team. We're not ready for someone to pass the baton to us and disappear. We actually want to join multi-generational boards, whether it's of our family foundation or the nonprofits in our community, so that we can bring to bear what we know and the skills we've acquired in this new age, golden age, and learn from the wisdom and experience of our elders. So I hope anyone's listening will reach out to the next gen and think about them as a partner to be on a team together to make an impact.
So they're kind of looking over their shoulder and saying, hey, anybody with the Rockefeller Foundation or that kind of a thing? Is that what you're saying? You know, like, hey, we, you know, not maybe so much as a mentor, but just include us at the table.
Exactly. We don't want to be at the kids' table, right? We don't want to be funneled into the fundraising committees or the youth boards. A lot of women said that I don't want to pick gala napkins anymore. I have business skills, legal acumen I could bring to the table. Consider how we could join as partners.
That was Sharna Goldsecker, who was in town last week from New York to take part in a conference examining the transfer of wealth and the giving tendencies of the next generation of philanthropists. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Formed in 1996 by frontman, guitarist, and lead vocalist David Noodle, the Sticklers are one of Honolulu's longer-running rock and roll bands. They're often likened to the Ramones and Joan Jett. The Sticklers have ventured out on several mainland tours, released an album called For Entertainment Purposes Only, and endured several lineup changes and breakups. According to fans, the band is known for their wild antics both on stage and off. You might remember them performing in 2000 at the Van Shoe-sponsored music festival Warped Tour and being kicked off stage for presenting a raunchy interpretive dance piece as an accompaniment to their song Red Ants. We thought we'd focus our attention on their song Boogeyman for our backyard quiz. In 2001, the Sticklers released a music video for the song that paid homage to a famous horror movie villain from the late 1970s. For our quiz, can you name which horror movie icon the Sticklers paid tribute to in their 2001 music video? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Brian Guadagno from Raw Elements Certified Natural Sunscreen. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Did you know Kona farmers made it into the Guinness Book of World Records for the largest mango, the largest avocado, and the largest jackfruit? Well, that's the rock star status of some of our crops. Tropical fruit expert Ken Love talked to us following a conference and series of meetings across the state with local fruit growers.
The transition from the plantation farming to small family farms, it's really kind of come full circle, where the small family farms are recognized as something that needs to be sustainable.
Well, we've been talking a lot about diversification for I don't know how long. And the question is, okay, well, what's going to take, right?
Well, you know, the big companies always came in and said, oh, you just grow pineapple, you just grow sugar cane, you just grow this and that. And what we found over the last 50 years was that when you have 10, you know, different crops based on seasonality, it was a much more stable environment. You know, you reduced, it was like a risk management tool. It reduced your need for excess labor or outside labor. Generally, a family could not only pick coffee themselves, but they could pick oranges and macadamia nuts and all the star fruit and all the different fruit that are available out there. And so now, when you figure that in terms of season, that kind of diversity and what the stores are interested in and the chefs are interested, it all seems to be coming together.
Well, what is showing promise?
In terms of fruit, I was amazed at the amount of wax jambu, which is a very close relative of mountain apple, the amount that's been sold around the state, even that we sold, was 600 pounds in 1 month at just our small local grocery in Captain Cook. That was amazing.
Well, I'm not familiar with that fruit. I know star fruit, but...
Yeah, wax jambu is a... it's a relative, very close relative of mountain apple, which is Syzygium. Hello, boys and girls. Can you say Syzygium? It's getting hard for me. Syzygium maliensis, and wax jambu is Syzygium samarkensis. And so the distinction is that the wax jambu, or wax apple as it's called, is much more shelf-stable than mountain apple. And the taste is virtually the same. So it's really an incredible fruit. And the same with the new varieties that have come in from other countries like the new varieties of star fruit and some of the Japanese mandarins and tangerines that we brought in. They really last a long time. They're good producers and something different for consumers and chefs to work with.
So now, can you do value-added products out of those types of tropical fruit?
Oh, I think we can come up with value-added products out of everything. Mountain apple sauce is just exquisite, where the wax jambu, if you have like those spiced apple rings from that, that's really good.
Now, I know there's a lot being done with breadfruit.
Yeah, sure is. And the breadfruit, although usually frozen, it's frozen into chunks or fries. I know my son's a chef and uses about 200 pounds a week of frozen local breadfruit.
Well, that's interesting because I've never had frozen breadfruit. I've always had it fresh. That's interesting to me.
I mean, sometimes when it's fresh, that's always best, but... you know, it's not in season 365 days, so in order to keep things on the menu, we have to preserve them.
I know there's some talk about producing flour potentially, but they need the volume.
Yeah, I think it's getting there. I know it's available in other countries. Being celiac, I'm very keen on being able to purchase breadfruit flour or jackfruit seed flour locally from local fruit. That would be ideal.
I know we've got a number of other fruits out there. Gosh, I believe on Maui we have the persimmon farm.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, Clark Hashimoto's persimmon farm is just it's a wonderful tour, too, if you get up that way, as well as having a great fruit. Unfortunately, we can't grow them at that lower elevations effectively, although there are different types of persimmons we can grow down Mackay, but it's just a different flavor and a different feeling.
And so, I know sometimes too that you've got to be able to get, you got to convince the farmers to try growing some of these crops. I know I did a story some time ago about the cashew farmer on Kauai. He had the most cashew trees in the ground. So it's just really interesting that, you know, you've got to get the farmers to kind of go out there and take some risks.
Yeah, one of the things that we've, thanks to the Department of Ag, we've had a number of projects where we could make the trees available to farmers at zero cost in the case of figs, or at very low cost in the case of different varieties of avocados and citrus. So that makes it a lot easier for them to take a chance on putting something in, like finger limes, which have gotten quite popular now.
I've seen those in the stores recently.
Yeah, it's getting there. There's three major farmers around the state, and you know, it's the chefs are arguably our best customers as fruit growers, and they're just trying to pick up as much of the fruit as possible. So even a producer like myself, I've also worked sometimes as a chef, and in fact tomorrow night at the Four Seasons in Hualalai, and I have to buy some of the fruit because it's off season here where it's in season on Kauai or in Hilo. And so by working together as a group as Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers, we're able to maintain the flow better, which will help wholesalers and individual chefs at high-end properties be able to a supply and keep something on the menu for some time.
What's the snapshot for citrus and mango?
It's definitely improving. We've got a lot of new mango varieties here to extend the season. We're utilizing new techniques. In fact, our recent conference brought in Peter Solares, who's a grower in Australia, and showed some of the growers around. Well, we visited most of the islands, and he explained how to make trellises so that the trees are very low and you can, it's easier to harvest. I mean, we don't need binoculars anymore to see if there's a couple fruit on top. You know, we can keep them trellised and keep them low. A couple years ago, we had Dr. Yonemoto from Japan come in and basically make bonsai mango trees. So I had a mango this year in a large 50-gallon pot that was no taller than I am, so it was about 5.5 feet, and it had 40 fruit on it. Well, it doesn't have the 400 of a big tree, but I can pick them and 7 minutes and get them off to market.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
You know, and in that space, I can put, you know, 10 trees that would cover the same area as one tree with 400 or 500 fruit.
So, and you bonsai them, huh? Interesting.
Yeah, what they grow in Japan, you can see a 10 by 10 foot tree that's about 3.5 feet tall with 1,000 fruit on it. So there's a lot of these techniques that we try to introduce growers to here, and some of them have adopted these methods, and it's helped to increase the production.
Right, increase your yield and make it more manageable, I guess.
Yeah, and reduce the need for external labor and make it easier to harvest. I mean, the labor is a major issue for us.
That was Ken Love, head of the Tropical Fruit Growers Association, talking about the latest fruit darlings. And for you foodies out there, we asked Love if he had a favorite fruit. He told us about an exotic called sapote, which is fairly new to the islands. Love says it tastes like chocolate pudding. Hard to find, but something to be on the prowl for. It's now time for a reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Chad Blair is on the line with an ad watch review. Morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, I did see that ad because it's embedded in your article today. I was thinking I was going to have to look for it on TV. Interesting.
Yeah, we've managed to avoid most of the TV ads since the primary, right? There really hasn't been much out there politically, but it's firing up, particularly over these two ballot issues, these statewide ballot issues involving the Constitution. And the latest one, the one that you watched on the article, is from a group called Preserve Our Hawaii. Who's that? Well, basically it's the Hawaii Government Employees Association. That's the largest union in the state, but they've got a lot of other people supporting them. The Chamber of Commerce Hawaii, lots of other unions, the Sierra Club, the ACLU Hawaii. And what are they arguing for? They do not want voters to vote for a constitutional convention. They say it's going to cost too much. They've cited the figure $55 million, although they haven't backed it up with any sourcing. But they're saying, look, that's not a good use of our money. We could spend that instead on things like, I don't know, fixing libraries, filling potholes, building affordable housing. So you'll be seeing that ad running quite a lot between now and November the 5th, the day before the general election.
It is interesting because you have a gal who's driving around town, you know, looking at our empty lots, thinking, oh, there should be a high rise with housing there.
Yeah, it's clearly filmed in Honolulu, and it has the closing caption, "Don't be conned." So they've got a nice little a catchy phrase. By the way, this is the third ad that we've seen just in the last week alone. There's two other ads running regarding statewide ballot issues. This is the other issue that's before voters, right? There's just two. One's a con-con. And the other one's called a Con-Am. That's a constitutional amendment. And in this regard, I know we've talked about this on your program, this would actually ask voters, should we amend the Constitution to give the legislature the power to levy a surcharge on investment properties? And, of course, that is something that's backed the Hawaii State Teachers Association. They very much want to improve schools. But these two ads are arguing, no, don't do that. That's going to cost taxpayers. So here we now have three ads running in opposition to the Con-Con and the Con-Am.
Right. And I know when we've had the HGA labor head, Randy Pereira, on our show, he had talked about, as far as the Con-Con, that labor doesn't really think this is a good time to open up the door because they're afraid of outside money coming in since the climate right now for labor is not good.
And it's interesting because, and of course, Randy, his organization sent us a statement that elaborated on their view. The ad doesn't actually mention things like collective bargaining. In fact, collective bargaining is very much at the forefront of concerns for HGA and other unions. That was something that came out in the 68 CONCON, preserving that right to bargain with the government over contracts, pay raises and benefits and so forth. They're afraid that if a CONCON happens again, that right is going to be gone. But it's not just that. They're also worried about environmental issues affecting perhaps Native Hawaiians. Remember that OHA, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, was established in a 1978 CONCON. Having said that, the ad doesn't mention at all the possible benefits that could come from a CONCON, like maybe a statewide initiative, a referendum process. But of course, that's not their job. Their job is to argue for voting no.
Right. And I know, I think we've had folks on who are concerned about, again, the climate when it comes to minorities, indigenous people, and certainly several Native Hawaiian leaders have come out, you know, to say, yeah, maybe this is not a good idea right now.
That's right. There are also some Hawaiians that I've spoken to who said, you know, maybe we need to make some tweaks to OHA, maybe improve the system. But we'll see whether these ads are persuasive. I'll tell you what, they are defining the argument early. There, as yet, at least as of Friday, looking at the latest ad buys, there's no organized pro-CONCON or pro-CONAM ads going out there yet, although I wouldn't be surprised if the Hawaii State Teachers Association does, in fact, running some ads that are in support of the CONAM. Remember, that's for schools to get more money for teachers and facilities.
Right. Lots of concern over that one, too. So we'll just have to see what pops up on the airwaves or on our computer as these ads pop up.
Stay tuned.
All right. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Chad Blair with Honolulu Civil Beat with today's reality check. To read stories about the constitutional amendment and the constitutional convention, visit civilbeat.org.
It's American Roots live in words and music from the Tedeschi Trucks Band, Randy Newman, Cajun Fiddler Doug Kershaw, and the Meters. We'll be on the rock and roll road, on stage at the Howlin' Wolf Club and the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots live from PRX.
Saturday evening from 6 to 8.
The recent close calls with hurricanes and tropical storms has renewed the focus on vulnerabilities of our emergency response system. The spotlight will be on ham operators and new training that is available this month. We sat down with Clem Jung, who's trying to spread the word about an exercise for amateur operators that takes place this Saturday.
So what we do is we support the National Weather Service with all their radars and whatever, ground truth. So what the eyes and ears, people, Sky One weather spotters see to verify what their radars are showing to them. So
you're the eyes on the ground.
Yeah, eyes on the ground, right.
We've got this event coming up, and you want all the amateur radio operators to know about this.
Right. Any amateur radio, whether you're associated with an organization or not, to participate, to use your equipment in case of emergency, practice. And we encourage them to go on using not the electrical power, but to use batteries, generators, solar panels, alternate forms of power to operate their radio.
Like you would in a disaster.
Yes, that's why. So we had the ARRL section manager, Oscar Resto, from Puerto Rico. He spent 2 weeks here. And one of the things we learned from him is that they use Simplex VHF radio to communicate. That's one of the things we're going to be using, simplex radio to radio communication, and also the idea of tracking damages on a map. So we want to simulate reports of damages throughout the state, and we put it on an incident map where the damages are for each island.
Many folks may not know that we have so many radio operators out there. I mean, you tell me we have like 3,700 licensed operators?
Yes, approximately. There's a lot of radio operators that are not that active. I call them ham on the wall. You know, they show their license, but they're not active. But what we learned from Oscar also, that about 5% of his radio operators, he had about 3,700 in Puerto Rico, that only 5% are able to perform MCOM duties because they become survivors as well, or they'll be affected by the storm. So though we have 37, we have maybe about, let's say, 200, let's say, are involved in MCOM.
What is MCOM for folks who might
know? Emergency communication. MCOM, emergency communication. Out of the 2,000 maybe, or 200, maybe only 5% are able to perform because the gear, the home got destroyed, the antennas get destroyed because the homes are destroyed. They have whatever emergency power they have cannot operate because they got destroyed. And so that's why we got to look at as many hams to be prepared that they can come up when there's a catastrophic disaster and be able to provide communication for the community.
So what will they need to know if they want to participate in this?
Well, we'll be on the second Saturday of October, and it's from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. It's only 3 hours, short time. And to work with other hams in there, and we're working with the district emergency coordinators. I have 9 of them throughout the state, and they are also trying to get the word out to the hams and the areas members in their districts to get the word out, this is what we're going to be doing, et cetera. And just get the word out on the nets, HF nets, on the repeater nets that I held almost every day, et cetera, to encourage hams to come up and on a simplex frequency that's going to be utilized in their district. And the scenario is a Category 4 hurricane that is moving from the south, and almost what happened with was that Hurricane Lane. It came from the south. It went to the west of the Hawaiian Islands. But this scenario will make it closer along the western shoreline of all the Hawaiian Islands, and is affecting all power, loss of power, worst-case scenario, affecting all counties, all islands, no power, no internet, therefore no water, no ATM, no banking, no pumping of gas, whatever. Roads are either blocked or destroyed along the shoreline, like we have Cam Highway, we have Kaneohe Highway, they're all shoreline. Farrington Highway going to Waianae can be inundated by the storm surge, debris, trees falling on the highways, like, for example, on Likiliki, Pali. And we have trees already falling when we had Lane.
That's
and
right.
That was just a tropical storm. Now, this is Category 4 hurricane looking at about 150 miles an hour. You know, so mudslides, landslide, rock slides, whatever.
Very real situations that we could be faced with.
And we've had incidents where we've had tropic storm or more tropic storm that happened to us recently, that we had mudslides, landslide, trees falling, blocking the roads. Imagine a Category 4, I'm not saying a Category 5 hurricane, but a Category 4 hurricane, which is more likely. And we've had a Category 4 hurricane, but downgraded to a tropical storm.
Yeah, recently. We got lucky.
Yeah, very lucky. What happened, and you can relate to what happened in Puerto Rico, ham radio operators was utilized for 6 long weeks, which is very unusual. Normally they're for 2 weeks, 3 weeks at the most, because the infrastructure were able to be, the power were able to come back up, telephones, commercial radio, first responder communication. But in Puerto Rico's situation, it was 6 long weeks. So if something similar happened here, it won't be 6 long weeks, or it could, depending on how bad the storm is and, you know, the power lines that could be affected, et cetera. So the amateur radio provide the communication where the what's happening in their communities, letting the county EOCs, like for Oahu, Department of Emergency Management, City County of Honolulu, what's happening out there in their community, where the roads are blocked, bridges are destroyed, highways are destroyed.
So you're the boots on the ground.
Boots on the ground, that because first responder communication may fail also. The fortunate thing about amateur radio, we have so many different modes and frequencies that we can use. We can have VHF, UHF, we have digital, we have analog, we have HF. And HF, we have different bands. We use mostly 40 meters and 80 meters, and we can use 60 meters. So we're not set to one frequency or a few frequencies like the first responders. We can move to different modes of communication, as well as frequency. We can send email through radio frequency, RF, just like regular email through the internet. We can do that with, through Windlink.
And I'm just curious now, as far as the reach across all the islands, do we have more ham operators operating on certain islands than
others?
Well,
most of the hams are located on Oahu, the population bigger. Then we have another group is the Big Island. The island is big. The population is probably the next one. Maui, and then Kauai is the smallest, but Kauai is organized. They learn from Iniki. So there's a group of emergency communication people that have been practicing working with the Kauai, used to be Civil Defense Agency, is now Kauai Emergency Management Agency. They changed the name early this year.
And you were with Civil Defense, State Civil Defense before?
Yes. When I was an employee, I was really concerned with state agencies. They depend so much on cell phone, landline, and internet. I asked them, and I was in operation after 3 years in training branch. I said, how are you going to communicate? Oh, we're going to buy Iridium phones, you know, satellite phones. And that's one thing we learned from Oscar. There's not enough bandwidth. They had satellite phones. But what happened is it brought a lot of additional satellite phones. It jammed up. They couldn't get to the satellites, so they couldn't communicate. So people think that they can communicate through satellite. Yeah, but people are going to be using the bandwidth, and therefore they won't be able to get communication. And that was a big problem on con to Oscar. So what it is I learned from, you got to have an amateur radio is when all else failed. That's the model.
Right, your backup.
We're the backup, of the backup.
Yep.
And we have to incorporate amateur radio in all our exercises so that when the time comes, and hopefully it won't, that we're prepared and they know the role of what amateur radio can provide. And that's coming now on the other side. I was emergency management on the other side. Now I'm from the other side. We need to incorporate more amateur radio in our exercise and also our state agencies and also county departments. You cannot use your present communication when the catastrophic event occurs. It will fail. We provide emergency communication when the time comes. From the emergency management point of view, amateur radio is free. Free labor. We cannot charge for our labor. We provide free equipment. We maintain our equipment. So when the time comes, we know our equipment, we can use it.
Basic but vital.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me to be here.
We were talking with Clem Jung about an upcoming exercise for ham radio operators. It takes place Saturday, October 13th. For links, check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with Christopher Phillips and Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer segment.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can try and spot in our dark island skies. As usual, we're so grateful to tap into the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we've got him on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars in the south after sunset. Also, Jupiter and Saturn can be seen low in the western sky. The moon this week is passing through its new moon phase and will herald a return of dark skies here in the islands.
There's been this recent discovery, and it involved Hawaii observatories too, as I understand, and it relates to a dwarf planet on the edge of the solar system?
Yes, more evidence this week for the existence of Planet X, and it comes in the form of a newly discovered dwarf planet in the outer solar system, only a few hundred miles in diameter, and it is currently going by the name of the Goblin. And the shape of its orbit could provide a clue as to the whereabouts of the theoretical Planet X.
It's not really a typical name for a planet. Is that just a Halloween-themed thing they're doing, or what's up with the name?
It certainly is Halloween-themed. Most of the observations of the Goblin occurred around Halloween of 2015, and that's how it got its strange name. The small dwarf planet is also so distant from the Sun that one orbit takes around 40,000 years. So we're quite lucky we actually found it.
And so how is this evidence for Planet X?
Well, the shape of Goblin's orbit indicates that something massive in the outer solar system could be having an influence on this tiny little dwarf planet as it journeys around the Sun. Astronomers are around 90% sure that this influence is the result of a Neptune-sized planet moving through the dark of the outer solar system, way, way out from the Sun.
And how come you can't see it?
These planets are so far away that they reflect practically no visible light from the Sun. And at that distance, the Sun is no brighter than just a star in the sky.
And when I first heard about it in the news, there was a few different places that were involved, and I saw Hawaii mentioned. Dial us in a little bit more on that.
So, it just so happens that our own Subaru Observatory atop Mauna Kea is one of the only observatories with a wide enough field of view to be able to explore the mysterious objects of the outer solar system. And the University of Hawaii is involved, and they are probably already hard at work tracking down this mysterious Planet X.
I get the feeling you'll have an update at some point soon, because there will be more about this ahead, yeah?
I certainly will.
Looking forward to it. It's Christopher Phillips and another fun report here on Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And we keep Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Earlier in the show, we focused on the Hawaii-based rock and roll band, the Sticklers, for today's quiz. Formed in 1996 by frontman, guitarist, and lead vocalist David Noodle, the Sticklers were one of Honolulu's older rock bands and have been likened to the Ramones and Joan Jett. Since their formation, the Sticklers have ventured to the mainland multiple times, released the album for entertainment purposes only, and endured several breakups and reunions. Fans say the band was over the top sometimes, like the time they were kicked off stage at the Vans Warped Tour for their raunchy interpretive dance to their song Red Ants. Today, we wanted to honor the band for their horror-themed song, and given that it's October, we thought it might be appropriate. In 2001, they released a lo-fi music video for Boogeyman, which paid homage to the famous horror movie villain from the late 1970s, and we wondered if you knew which one. The answer was Halloween's Michael Myers, but we stumped you on that one. No winners today. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Lots of questions, lots of fear. That could sum up the climate for immigrants in our country. This weekend, a new legal clinic hosted a workshop for those looking for help to navigate rough waters. Joining me this morning, Kuvei Hiraishi. You were at that workshop, huh?
I definitely was, yes. So the legal clinic for immigration is sort of still getting started. They don't have a home just yet, but they held this workshop for those who are eligible to become American citizens, so lawful permanent residents for at least 5 years, the whole shebang, green card holders, as you would. And the idea is, like you mentioned in that lead up, it's partly in response to changes in immigration policy at the federal level, but really just a response to the national rhetoric surrounding immigration. This is a process that everyone knows can be very daunting and expensive. Spoke to Amy Agbayani, one of the board members for this new legal clinic, to give us an idea of what they're trying to accomplish with this workshop.
Our work is to try and provide free or low-cost legal assistance to immigrants. And we're part of a national group of about 17 other sites supported by the Methodist Church, because it's clear that immigrants need legal assistance and there hardly is any available to them. We can't emphasize enough how important it is for these people to take the next step to become citizens. Otherwise, they're not going to be protected from a lot of the national, federal sort of attacks on immigrants, even legal immigrants.
That's right. So this was one of their first workshops this past Saturday at the First United Methodist Church. So the United Methodist Church nationally has this program to sort of help. A lot of their parishioners are immigrants and not yet legal immigrants, or some of them undocumented. Here in Hawaii, Agbayani was saying we have about 52,000 people in Hawaii that are green card holders that are eligible for citizenship but just never thought about getting it until now, where we're seeing a lot of changes and these green card holders want to figure out how to more permanently protect themselves from any changes by becoming a citizen. So I did get to speak to an immigrant from Tahiti. Her name is Patricia Wilson. She's 58 years old, and she's been in Hawaii for 36 years. She's had a green card the whole time, and she's perfectly content with having the green card. But now she has her two children who are a legal resident here in Hawaii and citizens, and then grandchildren. She just welcomed new grandchildren into her family, and she was sort of on that fence of, okay, I don't want to ever risk being separated from my family. So I'm just going to go through this process. There's this legal clinic. I'll go check it out. I got to speak to her, and this is what she said.
I never believed or thought I would become one until now. I'm so happy that they're here to help us so we could finally go through our papers without making any mistakes. And you know that once it's sent, it won't be rejected.
Wow. That's right. She was very lively interviewee there. But, you know, the mix of folks, there were about 20 attendees at this first citizenship workshop, and some were walk-ins, some forgot some of their paperwork because this is, you know, a very long process. But it was a mix of folks in terms of age, but I'd say I noticed a lot of older folks. Not all were willing to talk, even off record, but many were green card holders. So they were just residents for a really long time and only now taking that plunge. But this TLC, this legal center that is coming up, is sort of looking specifically to serve those seeking asylum, family reunification, and sort of this relief from removal, so protecting them from deportation, which is a completely different. These aren't these are the undocumented. Mm-hmm. I think we've got 45,000 undocumented folks here in Hawaii specifically, and the legal clinic is looking to sort of help them navigate this process.
And I know the local libraries have tried to do their part so that folks who have questions can go and get good information.
Exactly. And the Legal Aid Society was there. So there were maybe 25 volunteers. So these are lawyers, students at the law school came down. Legal Aid Society folks were there, and just anyone else who wanted to volunteer their time to the cause, because cost-wise, I mean, the application for naturalization is like $720. On top of that, if you do go and find a lawyer to help you navigate that process, that's going to be another $1,500, $2,000 for immigrants who probably don't have the means to that kind of money. So the legal clinic wipes out most of that legal fees by getting this pro bono help, and really makes it a lot easier. They were sitting there, the woman I talked to, Ms. Wilson, was there from 9 o'clock until maybe like 1, just sitting with a lawyer, going over everything, asking all her questions. And I think that really made a difference in terms of, you kind of heard it in her voice. She knew she wasn't going to be able to, nobody was going to question her, and she got her questions answered. And it's a process that will likely lead to her becoming a U.S. citizen.
I know I've seen lots of stories about folks who are really scared because of, you know, the policy about if you've ever tapped any federal assistance programs, right? And
yes.
They're like nervous because they're like, well, yeah, we need help, but then now how does that affect their ability to become a citizen, right?
No, that is true. And that was actually, there were some citizens. I spoke to John Egan. He was one of the immigration lawyers there on Saturday. He brought the folks over from the UH Law School to work with the immigrants. And he was saying that there is, if someone was a green card holder and was convicted of a crime and they came to the clinic, that he would tell them to go find, you need a secure legal help. Don't try to put your put your application through the naturalization process. It's going to be flagged and you may possibly be deported. And that is a real, it's a real
concern.
Possibility. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, permanent residency can be revoked, and green card holders can be deported under certain circumstances, especially dealing with crimes.
And you had mentioned that the church was involved because some of their members.
A large number of, especially the First United Methodist Church parishioners, are Korean immigrants, and also a lot of Tongan and Samoan immigrants. And so the legal clinic is also trying to work with the Catholic churches as well, because we do know there are a lot of Filipino immigrants in that parishion.
Right. No, Amy Abgani has been very active, you know, with her work at UH and reaching out to the Filipino community. Mm-hmm. So any idea when they might hold another workshop or where it might be?
Not anytime soon. I do think that they will have it at that First United Methodist Church. Partnership seems very good, and I think that's probably where it's going to be, but we'll have information if it does come up.
Okay, thanks a lot, Kuve.
Mahalo.
That was HPR's Kuve Hiraishi, who was there when a new legal clinic kicked off a workshop this weekend.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, our Hidden Side of Sports series continues with a look at how elite athletes are different from you and me.
I did a bunch of push-ups and sit-ups that night until I was throwing up.
And what if your goal is getting your kid into an elite university?
The answer, I think, is you want your kid to be a fencer.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Tuesday evening at 7.
On the next On Being, something completely different. Two lightning rod figures on opposite ends of the political spectrum in actual conversation.
If you want to persuade someone else, you have to be open to being persuaded yourself.
Sally Cohn and Eric Erickson together with me in Montana. I'm Krista Tippett. Join us.
Sunday morning at 10.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, what happens now that we've met Sophia the robot? We sit down with the futurist. We would like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.